clean line design that sets it apart from the lookalike.
Business is built on data, facts, and figures. It's also made up of some of the most fascinating stories the world has known. What makes business tick? What are the stories we can find in their failures and victories? Get ready to find out what some of today's leaders were thinking right now on Business Disrupted. Here is your host, Ted Gavin.
Welcome to Business Disrupted. It's been said that if you want to open a restaurant and have $1 million, start by opening a restaurant with about $5 million and just stop before you run out. It's an unforgiving business with a crushing failure rate and really low operating profit. And that's without the help of a global pandemic. Today on the show, in part one of a series that we will revisit from time to time, we'll explore how the pandemic forced new ways of thinking for restaurateurs and what business might look like when we're all past this. Joining us to talk about these issues are restaurateurs and chefs John and Karen Uri Shields. John is executive chef and Karen is executive pastry chef of sister restaurants Smith and The Loyalist in Chicago, Illinois. Chefs, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
So I should make a disclosure. My wife and I own a very, very small interest in Smith and The Loyalist, so I am not entirely disinterested in the day-to-day activities of Chefs Shields. That said, it's not enough to report for SEC purposes, so I think we can proceed without conflict of interest. So first things first, every superhero has an origin story. What are your origin stories? How did you get to where you are today?
Well, who's going first? I guess you want me to go first, Karen?
Sure.
Great. Wow. It's a long, long story, I guess, in some ways, sort of a fortuitous set of events that happened in life. And, I think an interest in cooking from my dad was what sort of got me off the ground in a way and pointed me in the direction of the culinary world. And through that, I think a few interesting books that came along and inspiring people that I was around sort of then catapulted it to the next level. So that was very lucky for me at the time, especially, when we were coming up. I mean, there was information was pretty scarce when it came to the culinary world. You had to either go to Europe and experience it yourself, or there might've been a few books out, but I was lucky enough to surround myself with those sort of people. And then from there, I think my own ambitions and drive sort of, took me to where we are today.
I grew up with a pretty big family, and so an Italian American family, and so food was always a big part of my upbringing, and we would spend Sundays and of course holidays just cooking all day and eating all day. And I think it was just sort of within my personality and my upbringing that I knew I wanted to go to culinary school, and I studied pastry. And so once I got there, I just knew that, it was really sort of love at first sight. I became, a teacher's assistant, and I would come in early and stay late. And, I just knew I wanted to work for the best and work as hard as I possibly could at any expense. And, in a lot of ways, that's what real life is in our business. And so, and then from there, John and I just worked as hard as we could. And then here we are, today.
And you both met working in the kitchen at Charlie Trotter's in Chicago. Is that right?
We did. Yeah. I was in pastry. I think I started about 6 months before John did. He was actually slated to head to New York. He took a last minute job and head to Chicago. So we became fast friends, two super, super dedicated, detail oriented people, working at Charlie Trotter's. And so we were friends for a long time before we became a couple.
And after Charlie Trotter's, John, you went on to Alinea. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. I opened Alinea with Grant, I assisted in the opening of Alinea, and I was sous chef there for a couple of years.
And so moving from a Michelin 3-star, very, very curated concept restaurant like Alinea, the two of you found yourselves in Chillicothe, Virginia, opening the townhouse, or I guess taking over the townhouse and making it your own. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right. We were actually slated to open Charlie Trotter's restaurant in Las Vegas, and we said, no, let's go to Chilhowie, Virginia instead, which was just the complete opposite of Las Vegas. And we feel like it was sort of, we came into our own in Chilhowie. We were able to like realize who we were as chefs and what interested us. But yeah, we were chef and pastry chef at Townhouse.
Okay. And then back to Chicago to create Smith and then also create the Loyalist. So broadly speaking, how would you describe each of the two restaurants?
Wow. Yeah, they're both very different, and yet there's a lot of continuity between the two, I think. Obviously coming from our personalities and sort of both sides of the brain, if you will. The Loyalist kind of leading on a more casual, everyday, sort of how we like to eat experience, especially more so now with the French sort of influence that's happening in there. And so I would say the Loyalist is actually a spot now where I've always wanted it to be, and so it's pretty excited about that. I guess it's one of the silver linings over the last year anyway. And then Smith is sort of more of our background of Charlie Trotter's Alinea, and then especially our time in Chilhowie, that really brings sort of the high end, the luxury and whatnot, that sort of experience, but then really grounds it with a real focus on products coming from the farms and real closeness with the producers that make them.
And Smith has a much more fluid menu than the Loyalist. Is that fair? You're really designing the day-to-day menu at Smith around what is available and what the farm that you're associated with, conveniently called the farm, is producing. Is that a fair description?
Oh, absolutely. That is one of the casualties of this past year. We're actually not working with the farm anymore. But it hasn't changed anything that we do in that respect. We've already had a number of relationships with other people as well, other farmers. But yeah, I'd say that's very fair to say. The menu is always changing. It's always about what's happening, these little micro moments of the season. You know, it's not just spring and summer and fall. It's about a planning from that time when the first things start to sprout and grow. And then how do we capture that in that moment, but then also capture that for the moment in maybe February, when nothing's growing in Chicago. So, but we go downstairs and we have jars and jars of strawberries that have been sitting in syrup, and we're able to like turn that into something else and give people sort of a taste of summer in the middle of February.
So that raises an interesting point. It sounds like with the two concepts, you actually have two very different supply chains and you have two very different planning processes to go from supply chain to food on the table. So you're very much running two very different restaurants.
Absolutely. I mean, really distinctly different. And then at the same time, there is a real connection in our approach to how we do things. But they're also two different needs from our guests, from our clients, what they want. And I think that's the most important thing, is sort of gauging that and knowing or trying to know what they're interested in, what they want to eat and what they want to feel when they come in. And so, yeah, that kind of changes how you approach both of them for sure.
So take us back to January, February of 2020, pre-pandemic. What is everyday business for two restaurants in the middle of winter in Chicago? What is business as usual before all of this happened?
Well, for us, I mean, we were incredibly lucky to be just busy, nonstop, both restaurants, really almost drowning in business in a certain way, with the sense of that our heads were just so in it. And what I mean by that is sort of after the pandemic, we've sort of come up for air a little bit and had a little time to breathe and a little time to think. And but we were, you know, incredibly lucky to be that busy, I would say, you know, during the winter season in Chicago. I mean, a lot of places are slower, but we were, you know, I think we pushed really hard those first couple of years and created a great base and clientele and reputation that sustained us through the sort of the slower months, if you will. So yeah, we were riding a high. We had, we were doing quite well, as you might know, and things were, looking better than ever. I'd actually dubbed the 2020 to be the, one of the greatest years ever. And just, shows you how little I knew about that.
So what were you, the two of you, first thinking when talk of massive social disruption in late February, early March, started to kind of hit the mainstream discussion? What were your instinctive reactions to that as to how you were going to manage the restaurant in this time?
I think I can answer that first. I think we were pretty, it seems like we were pretty much reacted similar to everybody else, sort of cautiously approaching it, you know, processing it all in a very pragmatic way, you know, realizing, you know, what could be happening, but not wanting to get ahead of ourselves too much and get ourselves too worked up. And so I feel like I was looking at it very, very cautiously, but if you were to say in end of February, March, do you think that this is going to last a solid year plus, but have an impact on your business for 2+ years? I would have said no, but of course that mindset quickly changed. You know, as you got into mid March, it became more and more weird, and then certainly by the end of March, you were thinking, okay, this is here to stay, and this is going to leave a pretty indelible mark on our plan and on our business. And so it seems like our thought process, and of course, we had sort of back channels with other chefs and other people who were connected, you know, politically, and they were sort of giving us hints that, like, this was here to stay, and this was going to be not only a regional issue and affecting businesses that rely on tourism, which is very much us, but this is going to be, you know, nationwide and then, of course, globally. So, you know, we sort of took it all in stride. I think I'm happy that we didn't get too ahead of ourselves and get ourselves too worked up. It seems like we went with the wave and we processed it all in real time.
So my recollection is that around the time, just before the mass shutdowns, but when it looked like that was going to be the next step, you came together with a number of Chicago restaurateurs and were pretty outspoken toward the governor of Illinois about providing financial assistance and support to the businesses that were going to be most directly affected. And in any community, that's going to be the service businesses. How did that project ultimately come together and start working? And frankly, did it amount to anything?
I mean, I think the restaurant community in Chicago really came together, and we were supportive of different efforts. Those efforts to you know, protect employees, and those efforts to protect you know, the paychecks that people were receiving, food on the table, ability to pay rent, et cetera, and then also, you know, supportive of the impact that the government's decisions would have on local businesses, and ours included. And I think my approach was just to be very sensitive that there was a lot of moving parts, and, you know, I didn't want to be, you know, narrow-minded and only have, you know, the business in mind, and then vice versa. I wanted to be sort of have a holistic approach to how can we get through this humanitarian crisis and financial crisis with our small business in a proper way. At the end of the day, the city of Chicago, state of Illinois, handled the pandemic very differently than some other states that really opened up and let things fly. Hindsight's 2020. I think, it's hard to say. I wouldn't want to say that I think that they should have opened up sooner and more aggressively, because I would never want to take a life over two guests sitting at a dining room table. So
sure. We're talking with restaurateurs and chefs John and Karen Uri Shields. If you have questions, tweet them to us at BIZ Disrupted or email them to comments at disrupted.business. And if you're joining the show on Facebook Live, put your questions in the comments right there on Facebook. So Karen, following up on what you were just talking about, in a New York Times interview in early April of 2020, Chef David Chang said, "Without government intervention, there will be no service industry." And this was after 3 weeks, probably not even 3 weeks, of sort of the first shutdown, which got us past the point where a lot of people thought, oh, this is just going to be 2 weeks and we'll be done. And when I think it really set in that things like travel and any type of external social activity in groups were not going to exist for a long, long time. Around the same time, the White House formed what they called the Great American Economic Revival Industry Group, which is a lot of words. And it was comprised of restaurateurs, Thomas Keller, Daniel Ballou, Jean-Georges Vongerichten, Wolfgang Puck, and then also the CEOs of McDonald's and Subway and Pepsi, among others. They are very, very different groups of people. And a lot of people would say that they represent nothing related to the average independently owned restaurant in this country. And the idea was for them to sort of come up with ideas that the industry could put in place. And it's not clear that they ever really did. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that everybody was sort of running and shooting and hope and trying to figure it out on the fly. Is that where the two of you were?
Yeah. I mean, we, like I said, we were supportive of those efforts, of the efforts of the Illinois Restaurant Association on a more local level, of the National Restaurant Association. So we did feel like there was a decent support of lobbyists, if you will, that were fighting for restaurants and for small businesses. Of course, what determined a small business was sort of a little bit vague for the first round of stimulus that got passed. And so but at the end of the day, we were grateful for the government help and very grateful for all of the efforts of the lobbyists. But no, without a doubt, a small mom and pop that really creates a community figure within a city and really gives a city its identity is a very different business than some of the large chains. At the end of the day, we were all wildly exposed, whether you're a, $50 million restaurant chain or, a $1 to $3 million small restaurant. At the end of the day, we were wildly exposed. And I think service is service. The McDonald's of the group and the fast casuals that don't rely on full service dining, they weathered the storm well, and if not, did better than expected in 2020. So it was good luck for, it was good timing for them.
So you get the word that everything is going to be closed. What do you do?
Mm-hmm. John.
What do we do? My gosh. Well, we try not to panic too much. We try to, I think it was hard to decipher what to do. I think it was a lot of confusion about where to go and how to do it. And I think we're all in the same boat. It was really sort of disheartening to be, like Karen said, so exposed and then have really no idea of how to how to navigate this new path we're on. We're on a new course now. The ship is veered off, and we're kind of lost at sea. And so we come together, and we rely on each other, I think, and then we just get down to business. That's what we do well, and I think that's what a lot of people do well when things are at their worst, or I think a lot of people that are really successful do well. They figure it out. They put their head down and they get back to work and they start doing what they did in the beginning, which is take risks, throw darts at, in different directions and hope that something sticks and just keep going. And that's really, there was no option for failure. I never for a second thought that we were going to shut our doors. And perhaps I think that's what makes us successful in a lot of ways too. Perhaps myself, I'm not going to say Karen, I'm a little naive in a good way, I think, optimistic. And so I don't allow those things to take over and sort of shut me down internally. And so that's what we did. We tried this, we tried that, we did this and we did that. And somehow here we are, full year later, still going.
So mechanically, when the shutdown happened, you had two operating restaurants, they had staffs, and then you had two non-operating restaurants. You had to furlough your staff. Mm-hmm. You then turned around and set up fundraisers to raise money for your staff. Mm-hmm. How long was it before there was a sense that you were going to be able to reopen? And what was the process of deciding how to reopen?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak quickly to that. I mean, at first we, like John said, we sort of, held our kids tight and held each other and we're just like, okay, we're just going to buckle up and we're going to do this. This is like our ground zero. It was like our world just got, destroyed by a natural disaster and we're just going to rebuild. And so we took about 4, 5, 6 days before we developed our first plan, which was to open for takeout, which we always knew would never be even close to the same revenue. It was just something to do, something to keep us afloat, something to keep us relevant. So, I'm not sure about John, but I feel like I never had a good sense of when business was going to get back to normal on March 16th or before the end of March. I kind of thought we might be in this for the long haul and we're just going to take it one step at a time.
And when you talk about reopening for takeout, is that for the Loyalist or is that for Smith or is that for both?
Well, we did both. I think we shut down. I mean, you have to understand, we shut down, we furloughed, then we started takeout immediately. It was really just for Loyalists. We didn't know which direction to take it out of, really. It was kind of, we were just Smith and Loyalists at that point. And the food coming out was from either or restaurant. At that point, I don't think it really mattered. I think everybody kind of went into this comfort food zone for a few months right after. And a lot of people were just supporting restaurants, trying to help out. And so we were just kind of doing what we always do, which was burgers. So we did some salads and things like that. And we were gangbusters. And then I think we switched to an Italian theme for a while, which is near and dear to Karen and I for her whole side of the family. And then right around that time, it was time to reopen, and right around June-ish, even though those 2 months felt like probably 8 months, it was pretty quick when we were back open again. And then sort of like, well, how do we navigate this whole new world again? We're back open.
And when you reopened, was that outdoor seating only? Was it indoor with half the tables removed? Was it different for the two restaurants? What was the choreography of reopening once we finally got to the summer?
I'll let Karen answer that. That's it was an integral part of setting all that up.
Yeah. So we, typically there's a bunch of, you know, sort of red tape that you have to go through to get a sidewalk permit. So City of Chicago was kind enough to waive a lot of that and expedite the permits for sidewalk patio seating. And so we definitely fast-tracked that, got together our perimeter and our tables. And that was... that happened in early June, and I believe in early June it was only outdoor seating. But we have a great huge patio, and so we were able to seat I think about 25 people at a time out there. And I think the city at the time had also time limits. Guests were only allowed to sit at tables for like an hour and a half to 2 hours. So that worked out, and it was a good liaison into when we did have to open for indoor. We were able to take it in baby steps, which helped us and helped our staff, because it was navigating all new territory with how to welcome guests, whether outside or inside, under all the COVID restrictions.
And so when you got to the point where you needed a staff again. Mm-hmm. Was the old staff still there?
At that point, a lot of them were. I mean, the hours of operation were different and the responsibilities were different. So there was a lot of meshing of responsibilities. You know, if before you were mostly a server, you might be a server sometimes and then sort of a server assistant other times, and then other times working on the curb, bringing the to-go food to the guests. So there was just an incredible amount of teamwork and dedication that, you know, our team was willing to just jump outside of their norm and jump into other roles and really multitask. So it did look a lot different at first.
And in terms of which concept you were operating, it sounds like from what you're saying, it wasn't so much a Smith menu or a Loyalist menu. You were serving food to guests at that point. Is that fair?
Yeah, for the to-go food was more like we were just serving, you know, food to guests. And then, mm-hmm. But when we opened the patio, it was easier for us to do the Loyalist menu out there. And then John could speak of when the whole French theme was born, because it was born around that time, which he's pretty excited about.
Well, we'll come back to that in just a second. We're talking with restaurateurs and chefs Karen Urie Shields and John Shields. If you have questions, tweet them to us at @BIZDisrupted or email them to comments@disrupted.business. Stay with us while we take a short break to listen to our sponsors. We'll be back in a bit.
Business news and discussions are always changing. In order to stay ahead of the game, sometimes you need to be a follower. You can follow the Voice America Business channel on Twitter at @VoiceAMBusiness. Again, that's @VoiceAMBusiness. And stay current.
Gavin Solmanese is the experienced leader for complex financial matters, restructuring, and litigation consulting. Whatever your situation, we have the ability and know-how to restore troubled companies to profitability and growth. We've successfully completed financial advisory engagements for hundreds of companies that have gone on to renewed health and success. No matter the size or complexity of the case, our clients always work directly with senior professionals and receive exceptional work product. We know that asking the right questions is always the first step in defining the true problem. Generating alternative solutions and finding a clear path forward is what we do. To us, it's all about results. What you do next is what counts. When there are tough decisions and hard choices to make, you need smart, strategic people beside you. Choose the team who never stops working until your problem, dispute, or financial crisis is resolved. Visit Gavin Solmanese at GavinSolmanese.com or call us at 302-655-8997.
If you hear a dog barking or an angel singing, then you know that you're listening to Waking Up in America. Heard every Wednesday at 3 Pacific Time, Valerie Kirkhard and all of her friends will bring you powerful and humorous discussions that raise thoughts and give you insight on how to live your life to its fullest potential. Adventure is always a must on Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkhard, every Wednesday at 3 Pacific.
You are listening to Business Disrupted. To reach our program today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to contact@disrupted.business. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. If you have questions for our guests, tweet them to us at BizDisrupted, B-I-Z Disrupted, or email them to comments@disrupted.business. If you're joining the show on Facebook Live, put your questions in the comments or just say hello. We're talking with restaurateurs and chefs John and Karen Urie Shields. John, before the break, you were about to get into the reopening and the what was driving the menu concept as you transitioned from takeout to seated guests and how it all came together.
Yeah, for the loyalist, I'll speak on that first. Yeah, that was really in the back of my mind of giving the restaurant some direction, I think. And, you know, it's weird to say it, but I think the burger, for people that don't know, the loyalist is really known for the cheeseburger. We got a lot of national acclaim for it and whatnot. And so that really started to drive business in a direction that we hadn't anticipated, I think. I think I sort of talked a big game before we opened the restaurant that I was going to make a good burger, and lo and behold, it worked out. And so, be careful what you wish for sometimes. And next thing I know, you know, we're slinging 200 burgers a night easy. And so it was great at the time. I loved it. And that's kind of what I wanted in some ways. I felt like if we had a restaurant like that, it'd be great. It just kind of runs itself. But the problem is then you also have a group of employees that you need to motivate and want to be there every day and perhaps didn't sign up for burgers either. And so, it was just a tricky game to play. What do the guests want? What are we known for? Where are we going? But really, in the back of my mind, I've always wanted this sort of French, like sort of direction, but like fun and not too stuffy and not really a bistro per se. And so the new menu really kind of leans into this sort of tavern meets a French bistro, maybe Joe Beef, and like for people that might know it in Montreal, and sort of feeling to it. So sort of a little bit rustic, but a little bit refined but fun. And that was the most important part. So it was our golden opportunity to go, if we're going to do it anytime, let's do it now. And so we did. So I'm really happy about that. Really proud about that. I was actually, Karen and I talk about it all the time. I was like, we're going to make something out of this whole pandemic. We're going to do things. We're going to pull out different ideas. And in the end, we're going to go down. If we go down, we're going to go down fighting and just trying whatever we can. So, it worked out. We had a few months. I guess we were open for June to maybe October. And then Smith, that was another, running two places that are so different. It was challenging. Our staff was nervous to be working with guests. Guests were nervous, but there, and it was just awkward. It was really awkward. I would say after a few weeks, it became more normal, but it was definitely difficult for sure. It was not just business as usual, as you can imagine. And it was hard to be motivated to create, to do new things, because that's really what Smith is all about. It's running with this little tiny micro seasons, being creative, letting things flow. And then when you've got all this on top of it, it's really hard to get in that zone and to make people happy. And that's really all you want to do at the end of the day. So it was difficult there, but I would say like towards before the second shutdown, I think we were on a good pace to kind of getting back to normal ish, so to speak, or we were just getting used to the new circumstances, I would say. That scenario.
So you mentioned something there that is interesting, and I want to dive into that. You mentioned that the guests were nervous to be there and the staff was nervous to be there. I understand why the staff was nervous to be there. It's a little bemusing that the guests were nervous to be there, because neither of these restaurants are a place where you end up. You set out to go to these restaurants. And so it's interesting to see somebody go through the number of steps you have to go through to get a reservation and then go to a place like Smith or to a place like Alinea or any destination restaurant, and then realize once you're there, oh, I may not actually be ready for this experience, and being surrounded by people and having staff hover right next to me, all in the middle of a pandemic. But I want to explore how the pandemic affected different aspects of the business. And you've talked a little bit about staff being nervous. How did it affect staff retention over as the pandemic played out? How did it affect your supply chain? You mentioned that the relationship with the farm is a casualty. Surely there were other effects. And from the perspective of the restaurateur, how did it affect you, the things that you need to operate?
Karen, I guess I'll answer that. I would say for Smith, you know, having the farm, the relationship we had with them sort of fizzle out was sort of the biggest, punch in the gut. You know, we weren't quite ready for it, but in the end, it was probably for the best for a number of reasons. We won't go into today. Too long of a story, really. But in other respects, as far as supply chain, we didn't really run into too many things. I would say, you know, prices of certain things might have fluctuated throughout the year, depending on demand. You know, at the same time, a lot of the things that we were looking for, let's say at Smith, maybe some higher end ingredients, whether it be certain shellfish or seafood, nobody's really ordering that to, you know, in boxes. So nobody was really even going, you know, it wasn't even a big deal because we weren't really looking for those sort of things. They don't travel well or package well. But when we did reopen, we definitely ran into a few things. The things that we were expecting or hoping to get weren't quite so easy to get anymore. You know, I think a lot of producers obviously went through what we went through, and we're, you know, we had an incredible relationship with a trout farm in Montana that just literally produced some of the best fish I've ever seen ever. And they shut down during that time. And so, and I'm sad for them. I'm sad for the guests not being able to eat this trout. I mean, it was incredible. And so that's one little small story, but there were a number of small ones like that. I wouldn't say there was anything traumatic about, you know, the supply chain, so to speak. I think people weathered the storm. I think people were able to get assistance along the way. And so I think a lot of people fought through and are sort of on the other side as well.
You know, you mentioned fish. I happen to live 5 minutes from a small fishing village that serves the restaurant community in my coastal Massachusetts hometown. And that fishing community was just decimated, because if you don't have restaurants that are open, or if you don't have customers going to restaurants, or your restaurant capacity is cut in half and everybody's ordering fish, all of a sudden you don't have anybody buying your product. And the ripple effects, you know, the second order effects of a pandemic that closes restaurants, that puts 8 million people out of work in the service industry. It's the greatest number of unemployed people of any sector in the economy was the restaurant and service industry. But the second order effects hit farmers, they hit fishermen, ranchers and meat processors. And then you get to the manufacturers and the supply chain partners, right down to the drivers that bring supplies to the restaurant. So the effects are just a ripple that go through the economy and leave destruction in their wake. So as you're facing these changes, you know, changes in what you can get, changes in availability as well as pricing, while at the same time trying to reopen these restaurants and keep control of them, what are you doing as a chef? What are you doing as a manager of staff? What are you doing as restaurateurs to try and get ahead of this curve?
Yeah, I think, you know, being malleable is the biggest thing. I think, you know, that's the word of the year, I guess, just being able to roll with the punches. I mean, at that point, I think we were, you know, sort of, we've been punching the gut so many times at that point, like many people, that, you know, nothing really fazed us in that sense. And if anything, I felt tremendous sense of loss for those people, the people you're speaking of, the people, especially the small fisheries or the small the companies that do these sort of specialized things that no longer have anybody to sell to. You feel for them, and in some respects, you don't have even a minute to sit there and dwell on it too much. Though you have to keep kind of pushing forward and going. And so, I think one of the first things we did when the relationship with the farm ended is we took over the roof above the restaurant and created our own garden immediately. I mean, even before the restaurants had reopened the first round, we said, okay, well, we're no longer going to be able to get these amazing herbs and you know, sort of show up at our back door, you know, picked by somebody who has the same attention to detail that we do. And so we're just going to do it ourselves now. And so we literally went up on the roof and gardened for weeks at a time to get it set up for the year. And that's what we did. And so we just kind of, again, picked up the pieces and found out a way to not really, you know, have it affect us in the long run. So a little extra work, but it was worth it.
So there have been a lot of transformations for restaurants that have names or that have followings or have wanted to create names or create followings. One of them has been to mail order. You know, Gold Belly, I think, has probably gained quite a number of customers. Is there ever going to be a loyalist cheeseburger on Gold Belly?
Darren, what do you think?
I may or may not have suggested that to John once or twice. John, your phone is there. Sorry. I may or may not have suggested that to John. Nothing was off the table at a lot of points within this situation. I'll throw some things by John and he'll either say that's a hard no or maybe get me more information. So I'm sort of the vetting stage of some right. things.
So
yeah, but if she really wants it to happen, I will find a way to make it happen. There's no doubt.
Okay. Well, so as you have reopened, when you reopened quickly with takeout service, and then as you reopened with outdoor seating, and as you look to reopening normal operations, if we ever get to what normal is. I'm interested in how your customer mix has changed. Who were your customers during the first, I guess, reopening after the pandemic set in, the takeout business? Were they existing customers? Were they new customers? Were they look-ins?
I think a mix of all. I think we had our core that was there to support us and do whatever it took to make sure that we were able to fight, you know, live to fight another day. And then we had a group that is, you know, was sort of like, were able to put on their bucket list. Like, oh, we got to, you know, finally eat at Smith and Loyalist. You know, they'd never had a chance to come before. So it was a big dynamic group, I think. And then, you know, like, you know, going to the guests that actually did come in, they, you know, I said that they were sort of, some might have been nervous. I think, you know, they would, you know, they maybe they didn't even know they were nervous until they got there, or they would hear that, man, we hear the precautions you guys are doing. We're so impressed. And so this is our first restaurant that we've actually eaten at since the pandemic had started. And so we got a lot of that. So it was a mix of all races and colors and ages and backgrounds. I mean, really.
And how do you approach the challenge of converting those first look customers in the heightened state of a pandemic and a limited menu scenario of a pandemic? How do you approach converting them to mainstays, to regulars?
That's a great question. That was something I was top of the list for me, is that, you know, we still have a reputation to uphold or a reputation to procure with these new guests. And so it's, it was a tough one, you know? And so I think the loyalist menu was probably bigger than maybe even Karen envisioned or our general manager downstairs envisioned in the team. And, I think we even pushed a little bit harder in a sense, made the menu even a little bit more dynamic, because I knew that this was our, there was going to be a lot of first timers. There was going to be, this is our sort of first shot at the French sort of theme. And so, if anything, I think I doubled down, or we doubled down.
So going back to the shutdown, you know, you have a, Smith has a highly curated menu, a highly curated wine experience that goes with that menu, which means that the wine you have is not necessarily going to be wine that you're going to use whenever and for whatever purpose. And anybody who knows restaurants knows that alcohol can eat up a lot of capital and represent a lot of expense and also a lot of the profit opportunity. And so here you are locking up your restaurant with a wine cellar full of wine that's really specific to menu decisions. What do you do in that scenario when you don't know when you're going to reopen? You don't know what it's going to look like when you do. You don't know what you're going to be serving. And yet you have a portion of this incredibly detailed and curated service that presents all sorts of problems with just fitting it into to wherever it's going to be usable if and when you do reopen. What are the practical effects of dealing with the raw inventory, particularly when that raw inventory is temperamental and subject to breakage and may not even be usable?
Yeah, it went, I can speak to that. It went through, a process, from late March to October to where we are today. We really approached it in phases, and the first phase was to hold on to inventory and sell as much inventory as we could with the to-go offerings, not buy anything new, not buying any inventory, just selling exactly what we have. And that worked for a while, and we depleted the inventory, the wine and liquor, wine inventory more so than liquor. Chicago was a little bit late on allowing restaurants to sell mixed cocktails to-go. And then as we started to open up, of course, now you're into summer. So the menu is, say, different than what it was in February and March. So the menu is different there. And we realized that we, needed to sort of change some things and maybe sell off some of our inventory and buy some inventory that was more profitable for the short term. So instead of, holding on to wines that were going to be part of a list, it was more like, we're going to be buying wines that are part of a more regular rotation and wines that we could sell to then turn some revenue on a faster basis. So it really did go through an evolution. And that's basically where we're at today. Our wine inventory is less for the long term, heavy on the list, and more so what works with pairings and what we could sell in the near future. And so it went through a decent transition there.
It sounds like it's just one more element of planning the menu around the raw materials. It's just one more ball to juggle while figuring out what you're going to serve and how you're going to serve it.
Right. And ultimately that is what the pandemic exposed wildly in a restaurant, as I'm sure other businesses as well. It really just exposed all of the nuts and bolts. Whereas under regular circumstances, we're a very well-oiled machine. And if you have a slow Q1, well, you have a Q2 or Q4 to make up for a slow Q1. And so those aspects of running a successful restaurant were wildly exposed. And, like we talked to our leaders about, this is like driving a manual car, a stick shift car versus just an automatic car. And everything needed to be done on a very manual sort of basis. Everything needed to be done specifically for operations and intentionally done. And so the inventory was one of those things, and food inventory as well. It was, everything needed to be costed out down to the gram, and recipes followed. And it exposed a lot of what makes restaurants profits so razor thin.
Right. So what is the status quo today? What are operations looking forward? What's the plan?
Mm-hmm. I think we could, John and I could probably both speak to that. I think we are very, very optimistic. As the pandemic exposed a lot of the challenges that we face as a restaurant, it also exposed what we're capable of. And at the end of the day, we're all in the business of hospitality, and we all just want to welcome our guests and make our guests feel happy and safe and comfortable, not only in the eyes of a pandemic, but just in the eyes of their regular life. And so we're super optimistic about what it is that we can offer our guests, the dining experience and the creativity of it and the atmosphere of it and the level of service that we can bring. So we're excited about the future, and we know that our longtime guests are ready to come back, and we know that we've sort of won over a group of new people, and John is feeling more creative than ever. And that's always a good thing when he's feeling creative and excited about the future. Then the menu is this really exciting evolution of excitement.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, just to add on to that, you know, I think one, I sort of have this mentality of, you know, when, using all these challenges as ways to learn. And I think I've always been that way. And so to me, along, you know, every little challenge we hit, I just kind of reverted back to, okay, well then I see where that's going. I'm learning from that. And that's how we'll get better the next time around. And so really, I think not only us, Smith & Lewis, I think many companies and small businesses are probably going to be, if they can make it through come out on the better side of things. I think we were able to clean up a lot of the things that maybe weren't so great, that we always wanted to change but couldn't change, not just the menu here or there, but just so many small things. And so, like Karen said, you know, Smith is, the menu right now is better than it's ever been. Our guests even tell us that. We, you know, our guests that have literally been there 40 times plus are amazed that we can continue to keep growing the menu, growing the staff, how we interact with the staff, not just the food, but the service and everything. So it's pretty exciting. And Loyalist opens in a few weeks, and so, or about a week and a half. And so we're excited for that as well. And we're ready to take on the new year.
Okay. Well, that'll be the last word. All right. Chef John and Karen Urie Shields, thank you so much for joining us today. The Chefs Shields are proprietors of sister restaurants Smith and The Loyalist in Chicago, Illinois. John Shields is on Twitter at Chef John Shields. Their restaurants are on the web at smithandtheloyalist.com. Smith is S-M-Y-T-H. And we'll link to their website and social media on the show's website under this episode's show notes. If you like what we're doing, share it. Talk about us on social media and spread the word. We are BIZ Disrupted on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And the more listeners we have, the more we'll have to talk about. And most importantly, thank you for listening. Join us next time as we explore the business of hacking and cybercrime with our guest, computer security expert and host of one of my favorite podcasts, Darknet Diaries, Jack Reesider. Next time, you've been pwned. Business Disrupted is hosted by me, Ted Gavin. Our executive producer is Robert Cellino. Our audio engineer is Aaron Keller. Our theme song and other original music are by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Branding by Peg Fitzpatrick and PMG Group. PR and social media by Kara Lunger, Emily Stern, and ABNC Creative. You can find episode guides, show notes, and sign up for our newsletter at our website at disrupted.business. Email your thoughts to contact@disrupted.business. You've been listening to Business Disrupted on Voice America Business and the World Talk Radio Network.
Thank you for tuning in to Business Disrupted. Be sure to join Ted Gavin for another edition of the program and some more great stories next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until we speak again, have a great week.